watch. What you wanna watch.
Welcome to Netflix Has No Chill. I'm Adriana.
And I'm Zach.
And
question mark?
We have a lot of stuff to discuss.
Yes, tonight. Many, many mucho thoughts. So strap in. We have quite a wide variety of things to cover today.
Yep. Especially since you have probably a lot of questions.
Yes.
That you need answers to that you won't necessarily get entirely, but that you will at least be satisfied a little bit by knowing the updates on the Stephen Avery case.
Exactly. And Brendan Dassey.
Can't forget. Whatever. Poor Brendan.
Okay. But first, we need to do our little mini reviews, so to speak.
Yes.
So hit that timer, baby. We saw this weekend the new movie Bohemian Rhapsody, starring Rami Malek, a biopic about the life of Freddie Mercury and of Queen,
but half Freddie Mercury, mostly Freddie Mercury, the Queen. Yes. So
the Queen, yes. Freddie Mercury. And also kind of centering on the creation of that song and how it really kind of defined the band in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And their creative process and also the products that they made.
I'd been wanting to watch this movie just because I really like all the top 10 hits of America. And I think one of those is definitely Bohemian Rhapsody.
Hmm.
I feel like it's an internationally known song.
Yeah.
And it definitely made a mark in music history.
Certainly. It's billions of people know that song.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And a couple of years back, I saw actually on Netflix, there was the concert. They had done a remastered version of one of their live concerts.
Okay.
And
Did you watch it?
Yeah, of course. I watched the whole thing. And it was really great because I started recognizing, like, how beyond their years the music was.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't believe that this was, like, in the
70s.
It was, like, the 70s. And I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
This is so good.
That was almost 50 years ago.
Yeah. And their concert, like, their lights and everything is very dated.
Yeah.
But their style,
the actual sounds that they're making together are beyond their time, for sure.
Very good.
Yeah, I never really appreciated how much of a creative influence they were on people of that time. Like, their reach was so wide and so profound to a lot of people's lives that seeing this movie, I hope, does justice to that memory. It probably, I would say, buffs some of the edges out of the, you know, somewhat harder story of Freddie Mercury's life.
Yeah, definitely, because we don't really know much of, like, even though he was a very public figure, he was a very private man, I feel.
Yes, he was publicly very performative, but privately very, like, seems like to himself, and once the doors were closed, he was a different person.
Yeah, and I think the movie does a really good job of keeping it almost, like, PG.
Yeah. It's on the edge of PG-13.
Even though it's rated PG-13, but it keeps it PG.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not much of the sexuality aspect.
No. For someone who is self-professing his own, flamboyance, it is very kind of reserved in how much it shows us of that lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to the movie's benefit, it does that, because it doesn't get distracted in what is ultimately not the thematic core of this character's story, which is what I liked about this movie. So I think,
I think
it's a very well constructed, and it shows us really the main pillars of the Freddie Mercury story that we need to understand his emotional arc and where he was going into that fucking final performance, which, my God, do they earn that final performance.
Oh, so good. It's also good because it kind of talks about what he's going through during that time, which I don't think a lot of people really
understand. No, because of how private he was.
Yeah, the fact that he died from AIDS.
Right.
And it's crazy, he died 4 days after I was born.
Right.
And just hearing that was still, like, it was almost a part of my life.
Right.
You know, it was just almost there that I was alive when Freddie Mercury was alive.
Yeah, for like
and
3 days.
Yeah, for like 3 days, and then he died.
Yeah, I missed that boat.
Yeah, and but no, it's really great. They did some really great casting for this movie.
Incredible biopic casting.
Yeah, yeah, everybody
the who band is, members look insanely good. The costuming and makeup is great, but even like the acting and performances, they look so much and recreate so well the Beatles perform the Beatles the fucking Queen experience and the performance on stage. It's very, very well made.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Brilliantly directed by Brian Fuller, I would say. Like, well done.
And it was fun watching it. We watched it in like an Atmos theater, so it's completely surround sound and incredible just hearing sound. It and the music. I love their music, and Love of My Life is definitely like it has a sweet spot in my heart.
Sure, yeah.
And hearing the story behind it, because it's so funny, because I whispered in your ear, I was like, this song is about that girl.
Right.
And then immediately it goes into that story of like, this is for you.
It's like, yeah, that's what this movie's gonna be about.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was beautiful to watch, because I don't think a lot of people know that story.
No, I certainly didn't.
I don't think a lot of people know that there was a girl behind Freddie Mercury who was like always supportive.
Right.
And always there.
Yeah.
Even though Freddie Mercury is somebody that you can't
keep to one person.
Yeah, you can't keep.
Yeah.
He needed to be shared with everybody.
Yeah, he was too bright of a light to keep inside, almost.
Yeah, but I liked it. I don't think it's like Oscar worthy. It's not one of those movies that I was like, oh, this is gonna get an award.
Maybe his performance will, though.
Oh yeah, I think
Rami Malek is insanely good.
He is.
As Freddie Mercury.
His little quirks and everything. Oof. I think his concert, his, like, performance
Yeah, persona. I feel like he memorized exact choreography from his performances.
Yeah, definitely.
And then, like, re-articulated it in new ways.
Yeah. And I think also the guitarist does a really good job, too. I don't know who that actor is.
Yeah, the lead guitarist is, yeah.
But he did an amazing job in kind of even to his voice and everything.
Yeah.
It was so good. But I mean, I don't think it'll win any awards in like, just in the aspect of like originality. Like, it won't win like best movie.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's probably best picture. Fair to say. Yeah, but something. I think he'll definitely get an Oscar nomination for it.
Maybe.
For his performance.
He did a really good job.
Yeah.
Agreed.
But yeah, this movie is sort of like if you took, almost like a Whiplash, like that kind of like fast-paced music, using that to really inform the emotional storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
But if you took that and you smashed it together with like the Steve Jobs movie, like it's like the baby version of that, directed at a Freddie Mercury life story. So like it's a very fun, very stylized, very well-made movie.
Yeah.
And if you are at all a fan of that music or those people, definitely check out the movie.
Yeah, I definitely agree. If you like the music, if you're a fan, which
who isn't? Yeah. It's you realize how many songs wouldn't exist
if Queen,
like this is what
if
I said
Freddie
to you,
Mercury didn't.
After the movie ended, I was like, What did they do at baseball games after people won before Freddie Mercury came up with We Are the Champions?
Yep.
Like, what did you sing at the end?
Yep. Well, how?
Like
how
the dun-dun-tsh, dun-dun-tsh.
Well,
that's
actually,
like at every sporting event.
Yeah.
Like, those are huge cultural touchstones all created by this one.
Well, I would say it's a team
sure.
effort, but honestly, he is the brain behind most
he
of
was
it.
The spark he was
but,
the catalyst
yeah.
that created Queen
yeah.
and then the whole conglomeration of them took it so far. They took that ball and they ran with it for fucking like 20 years basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a very well made movie.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
It's in theaters now and
mm-hmm.
Will be maybe for a bit.
And then once it's not in 13 days, it will be on all of the streaming sources.
Yep.
Soon.
Yeah. But definitely
worth the time, yeah.
Yeah, something to watch in theaters, especially for the music. But
now for the feature presentation, we're going to talk to you guys about season 2 of Making a Murderer.
Because let's be real, you don't need to sit through this. You just need to be updated.
Yeah, you and I were having this conversation about what this podcast is for. This podcast is to save you time. If you're curious about how documentary series end, but you don't want to invest all the time, I get it. Because
especially for a part 2, because
my
there
God,
wasn't
a part 2. Like there wasn't that much stuff that happened in 3 years.
Yeah, and also it's almost like the jinx.
Yes.
If we had created a part 2, you definitely want to watch it, but I'm like, is it going to have
how many episodes?
Also, what are you going to give me?
Right. What I see how this show is unfolding, but I'm not sure it's going to continue. It feels like diminishing returns
yeah.
is around the corner. So we are here to save you a few hours of your life, or yeah. to encourage you to sit through
maybe
and
watch it. Maybe and, you're yeah. like, oh shit, I want to know the details.
You
want to
know all
it.
Of the little nitty gritties? That's great. This show does a great job of exploring yes. them. Okay,
so let's go back to
let's
the
give some
first
context.
The first season.
Yes.
So the first season, we are introduced to Stephen Avery.
Sure. Well, first of all, what is our relationship with it? We watched the first season when it came out. We binged the hell out of it.
Yeah, we
were
did.
Obsessed with
we
it
were
for
so
that like
obsessed.
2 weeks.
Like I was signing petitions. I was like. I was like, get him out of Pez!
He's an asset!
Yeah, like, so difficult.
I just remember also about a month later, I read some things that were like, well, maybe he's not. He seems kind of weird. Like, yeah. there was like a lot of unanswered questions at the beginning of it. And I didn't even realize there
I
was going to be a part two.
This is just such an interesting case because America felt so moved because we are all watching.
Yes.
Like, if it, I would even consider this almost the same or bigger than the OJ trial.
I wouldn't say bigger yet. Like, it has the potential to really be. Like, if he
but
gets...
But we were all talking about it.
Sure,
we
you're right.
We were all talking. It's on that level where yeah. this is a high-profile case.
It captured the American culture for, like, a month.
You can't go anywhere, I feel, right now and be like, oh, the Stephen Avery case, and people are like, what's that?
Yeah, nobody
I don't
has...
Feel
everybody
like,
has an opinion on
I don't
it now.
Feel like you could get a fair trial from this. Ever.
Yeah, probably not, no.
People are biased to yeah. what media is telling them.
Sure, sure. But I also feel like much of what is presented in this show is legitimate fact and should have been considered at the time.
Agreed.
But I don't think there's
but it
possible
is very
for
one-sided.
Him to get... Yeah, exactly.
This is a very one-sided documentary.
100%.
Anybody who is related to Teresa Halbach and or knows anything about them, I bet this is very difficult to watch. This
perhaps.
Is, this
yeah.
is something where it's like you're... One, he is now a celebrity. No matter what, how you think about it, Stephen Avery is well-known.
Sure, he's at least well-known, possibly
face.
Infamous to some people,
his
though.
His face is known.
He's definitely a celebrity of some level, yeah. He's a known quantity, that's for sure.
Yeah.
He went from nothingness, basically, to
from
being put on the
Wisconsin.
National spot. Yeah, just like running a junkyard.
Yeah.
To having the fucking national spotlight shown on him while he's sitting in prison for the second time. It seems like he was wrongly put there for the second time.
Yeah. And...
Okay. So this is the general...
Yeah, this is how we started. We had watched this a while back, but now...
Right. We're like, what? There's a part two?
It was one shocking, and we were very reluctant to start.
Yeah,
because it was
we
just
waited.
Like...
Meh.
So?
Do I want to get back into the just, like, pure tragedy? Just wall-to-wall hell that these people are living
we
through?
Know...
Everybody involved, it's not a good time for
we
anybody.
We know this isn't going to end... with a typical, like, a typical story.
Sure.
This isn't a movie. This is real life when
right.
you think about it.
Right. And it takes for fucking ever.
Yeah. Which is, that's real. The court system takes forever. Like, that's how you know, in a way, it does work. But it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's flawed, but it works.
Right.
And
it just moves.
It's just so slow.
And for the first time in human history that we know of, like, things can move very quickly all of a sudden. Like, we have Twitter now. When
yeah.
this was written, there was no idea of that, right? So it's intentionally slow, but it was as fast as it could have been back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're using that same system, and this documentary is now informing how that proceeds, right? So this is like a first time we're using media in this new way, this streaming service, to change how justice is dealt out in our country for the first time, really.
Yeah.
So I think it is... like the OJ trial in that way, in that it is a new step in our American justice experiment.
I just think it's so in the media and in the news, and it's in our homes. Like, it's so easy to access this information.
Sure.
That's what I mean when it's, like, as big as the OJ case, where
yeah.
everybody with the OJ case back in the day was just going to the TV to watch.
Right, right. Everybody
and
knew about it.
And
yeah.
now we have it streaming...
But I don't feel like throughout the last year I've been paying attention to the updates. Like, my engagement with this is only through Making a Murderer, and therein lies the bias, for sure.
Yeah, I guess. But
right?
there are some people who are very... who want to know, who are
yeah.
Googling, who are constantly... But there's also those updates that you randomly get where it says something about a Stephen Avery. Like, I'll be on Facebook, and randomly I'll get, like, this new... notification or somebody reposted a page about the Stephen Avery case, and I'm like, oh yeah, what happened with that?
Oh, I'm always just like, I never clicked those.
Well, let's recall what happened. So in season one, it gives you the story of Stephen Avery, how he's grown up as kind of like an outsider with his whole family.
Yeah.
And then he is, he's tried, well, not even tried. No, he's just seen as guilty for assaulting this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And is put in jail. This whole case comes in 1985.
Right. The first time.
18 years. The first time.
Right. Yes. There's this chick running, and he's wrongfully committed for raping and murdering her.
Yeah. And she also says it's him. That's the worst part, that there's a person who is alive who can say that's the guy who did it. That's why there was no real trial.
Right.
And then years later, he keeps saying that he's innocent, and that new DNA is found to say that, no, it wasn't him. It was another dude.
Right.
And then you go into his backstory of how, like, you know, he's a troubled guy. The one thing that really stuck to me is that there was the story of animal cruelty where he doused a cat in gasoline and placed it on fire. Like,
sure.
When he was younger. He also has an IQ of 70.
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
Yeah, this is a whole bunch of people who are not the brightest bulbs in the box.
Nope.
And so...
I don't think that's the saying, but it's okay.
The metaphor works, I'd say. They're doing things that from the outside can be misinterpreted easily and can be woven into this scapegoat story, right? Mm-hmm. So it's easy to say that those weirdos over there at the junkyard are doing stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Because they are doing stuff.
They're like the outsiders.
But like, really, they seem to just be minding their own goddamn business. And picking through everybody's junk and finding out what's good and what's not good and selling it and largely maintaining this junkyard.
Yeah, and it starts getting very interesting because when he is charged, this is where the whole cop thing comes into play.
Right.
Why are the cops so, like, against the Avery family?
Right.
Why does it seem that way? So the woman who was accusing him was actually, I believe, married to the county deputy.
That seems like a conflict of interest.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just like, I don't know, how do you do that unbiasedly?
Right. There's got to be some level of small town politics at play here.
Oh, definitely.
Because
most definitely,
if you were to write the show of this, there is internal squabbles between all of these people because there's not that many people around, right? So they're constantly interacting with each other, and you know, if the cops have a reason to pin it on this person, and they don't really want to do their jobs. The laziness plus easy opportunity to blame someone like Stephen Avery.
Yeah, especially if it's like almost like a passionate thing.
Yeah.
Where
and then once
as
you start
husband,
to believe the...
You get it. As a husband, imagine your wife tells you this man did something to her.
Right.
You're like, fuck that guy.
Yeah, I'm never going to believe a word he
I'm
says.
I'm never believing anything. But then also there's so many other things. She... easily could have. I don't know what the end result was. I think that maybe she, I don't know how
she who?
Mistaken the lady who was assaulted.
Oh, okay.
Like, I don't know how, but when you see the guy who did do the crime, he kind of does look like Stephen Avery.
Right.
So I understand.
It's not out of the picture. Yeah.
Where she might have been like, that dude, I've seen him before.
Right.
You know, whatever.
Right.
So,
or she was subtly persuaded by the cops, right? In the same way we see them do that with, like, other people in the show, right?
Yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of weird shit happening in this town, and none of it is really explicit, and none of it is, like, fully criminal, but in the end, it results in Stephen Avery being in jail, like, 35 years of his life now.
Yeah, and, yeah, so now we're, for season one,
we're exploring the case of Teresa Halbach.
Yeah, we're out of jail. He's living his life now. He's so happy.
Right.
But now, again, something happens where a lady has gone missing.
Right.
And there's evidence that is seemingly, like, so perfectly placed.
Right. It's somehow tangentially connected to the Averys, and there are, like, a series of single dominoes that connect them yeah. to this dead woman. And so because of Avery's past and the unsavory quality...
And because she was the last person... Like, he was supposed to be, apparently, the last person to see her alive.
Sure, yeah.
Because she was photographing.
Right.
She's a photographer.
Right.
And he owns a junkyard with cars, right. and she would photograph for the auto trader. Right. So if they had a car that they were like, oh, we could actually sell this. Mm-hmm. This is actually a pretty decent car. She would come over and take a picture of it.
Right. Send it back to auto trader. Yeah. They'd give her $50 or whatever, and so then she'd go home.
He's one of the last people to see her alive.
Right. She does that. And from all the records, it seems extremely cursory. But yet he, like, later her car is found on his property, mm-hmm. and, like, a week later there's, like, some DNA found on his property, and then
a key to the car is found in his room, just, like randomly, perfectly, like, kind of in the back. The fifth
time they search a room, they're like, oh, yeah. look at this thing that we would have found the first time, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, it's very strange.
So there's all of this evidence, and so the documentary, the first season, explores all of that and goes, basically, we don't really think Stephen Avery's guilty. We don't know that he's completely innocent, but there's reasonable doubt here, guys, and he should not be in jail for the second time for a long time for something he didn't do.
But basically, also, season one ends on a really difficult note where you realize you lost. You realize, like, no, this guy isn't getting out.
Right, and he's going to stay there.
And you just watched all of this.
Right. You sank 10 hours into finding out that the guy who went to jail is still in jail mm-hmm. for a thing he probably didn't do.
That he keeps saying, I didn't do.
Right.
And then the first thing he's saying is, like, the cops did this.
Right. This is... Yeah.
And it's sad. It's sad to watch it because if his story is true,
mm-hmm.
then it's just so fucked up. The whole system is fucked up.
Yeah.
And how... And whoever did it is out there, right. just being like...
Yeah, dude, okay. So, let's dive into some spoilers, because season two picks up the ball from where season one ends and updates us on 3 years later. There's 10 new episodes, there's a new lawyer involved, there's a whole bunch of new stuff. So, here, we're gonna do some light spoilers here.
Whatever, no, we're going into spoilers because this is what you need. You don't need to watch...
You can either watch this if you want to sink 10 hours in, or you can listen to us talk about it.
It's very dragging. No, I'm gonna give my honest opinion. This is...
Please, let's talk about that.
This is so dragging. There are shots...
There is 4 hours of content in this 10 hours of this season.
Let me tell you something.
Please, tell me something.
As my dad says.
Tell me something.
Let me tell something to you. If you're gonna see anything... in this documentary hundreds of times, I feel it is the same perfect fucking picture of Teresa Halbach with her camera in front of her car.
You're gonna see, like, that a lot.
You're gonna see so many times.
A drone shot of the prison once an episode.
Drone shots of everything.
Drone shots of everything, like, the downtown. But the same drone shot of the mm-hmm, prison mm-hmm. once per episode.
Yep.
You're definitely gonna see the picture of Teresa Halbach. You're gonna see probably some of the videotape footage of Brendan Dassey's...
Giving every his confession.
Every episode starts with Brendan Dassey, like, slumped in the corner and being coerced into confessing.
Yep.
So there is a fuckload of filler in this second season.
Yeah, like, why did they need to do that?
Episodes 1, 5, 8, 9, 10 are important. The rest of them you could skip through and kind of get the main story, because a lot of the details are kind of like meandering, like, attempts to get people out, and they ultimately just get shut down, right? So the courts are like, no, no, no. And so they keep trying these things, and you're like, oh, it might work. Doesn't work. Oh, it might work. Doesn't work.
We're also just saving you from the phone calls that they make to family members, mm-hmm. because they just have phone calls that kind of are like, oh, well, let's just put this as a filler. But honestly, it leads to nothing. It's just people talking about nothing.
It is nothing conversations. It's like, over nothing B-roll footage.
It's like Brendan, who did the confession when he was 16, talking to his mom and just being like, well, I don't know.
Yeah, you know. Oh, I'd like to get out. Oh, I bet you would. Wouldn't it be great for you to be home?
Yeah, I really miss you.
Yeah. Okay.
Well,
I got one minute left.
Know, you're innocent, so...
You know, it'll probably work out for you.
So it doesn't matter.
We just keep working here.
That is exactly what the phone calls sound like. It's just...
There's, like, one or two interesting phone calls, but
That oh, is only one interesting yeah, phone call, let's be honest. Real. And that's episode one... 9. Like,
no, that's episode 10. It's right at the end of the series.
Oh, shit. Okay.
It is. That is a bombshell of a phone call.
That is a really good phone call.
Wow. Okay. But so
let's back up.
Yeah. Let's back up to the main new addition, let's say, to season 2, which
she
is
Yzma.
Kathleen. Yeah. Yzma the lawyer, also known as, what's her name? Kathleen something. What's her fucking name? Kathleen, where are you at?
I also wanted to say real quick that Stephen Avery, after he got out of jail, was going to be paid about $36 million from the Manawak County.
For his first bullshit
Because
thing.
They fucked up and because they lied and because they planted, so they were like, oh shit, you know what? We'll just pay you this money because we fucked up. What a coincidence. And now he's back in jail, and I'm like, wait, so what happens with that? Do you still have to pay him while he's in jail? But since he's in jail, isn't that your system, and isn't it just going right back into your pocket?
Right. He's got to pay to get in jail, or pay the bail to get out of jail.
It's basically, like, I think it's basically them paying themselves.
Yeah. They're like, okay, well, we're just going to not do anything with $36 million this year, I guess, while we pay it out to that
dude
who pays it right back to us.
We have to wait
until
he gets out of jail.
Yeah.
Which, it says, I think, life...
Yeah.
Life in jail
this
is his.
This life in jail prisoner will get his money when he gets out of jail.
So fucked up.
That's dirty, man. That's real
so
shady.
So fucked up.
Yeah, it's... I don't know that there's any, like, one evil force behind this, right? That's the Hollywood version of this. I think this is the totality of human stupidity and laziness just working against these unlucky people. Like, it's the sum total of all of these small things adding up together in him staying out of there. Like, the 1996 law by Bill Clinton that, like, diminishes habeas corpus, which is only specifically targeting this case, basically. Like, cases of this type, which says instead of it being 90% of them are correct and 10% are innocent and go free, now it's only 1% are innocent and go free, right? So it just makes everything harder for this guy who is clearly, like, has reasonable doubt here.
Yeah,
and
so much
if it
is
were
presented,
retried,
so much is presented in this new
season
that you realize, you're like, oh shit, they missed a lot of information from the last case.
Yeah.
But she's also just an incredible force to be reckoned with.
So Kathleen Zellner, who is great on Twitter, definitely
follow her.
She has 500,000 followers on Twitter already,
dude.
As she should. She basically saw season one, I feel like, and was like, all right, get me this case.
But I think they had actually tried to contact her and be like, yo, help us. And
please,
she didn't respond for a while. But I'm sure after she saw the Netflix,
like,
she was like, oh, this is the case you guys
I
want me to take?
I could do that and make money. Cool. I'll do that and also make a fuckload of money. Cool. Okay, let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she is great, though. Like, the problem is with this season, basically the first 5 episodes are slowly spoon-feeding you what she does over the course of a year, right?
So
episodes
slow.
1 through 5 tell you nothing until episode 5, and they're like, this is probably who it could be, right?
Yeah. So episode, like, 1 through 5 is basically her saying what she needs to do
and how the other people
fucked up. And how, and how everybody kind of sucked. And she's like, all these men fucked up, and...
That's the
this
underlying
what they
message
did.
Of everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And
even
then
the female judges are the only ones really standing up for people. Like, she is coming in here and just being like, you dumbasses didn't even think of this. You should have called these people. This should not have worked. How dare you?
This,
like,
is what you should have asked.
Yes.
Why didn't you ask
you
about
this? You overlooked
this.
You didn't call these people.
Yeah. So many things. But at the same time, in season 2, we're also following the Brendan story.
Right.
Of the young 16-year-old boy who confessed to a fake murder.
Right.
Because it just seemed like the right thing to do.
Because he wanted to get out of the fucking room with them. Like, he was
there
for hours on an afternoon by himself,
unfed. I think it was very correct what that one judge said, where it was just like, it was so cringing to watch.
Yeah.
It was like skin crawling.
Yeah,
to watch how the cops interviewed this little kid.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wonder, I'm like, I feel like in most interviews, it should be like a parent with a child.
At least a parent, if not also a lawyer.
A lawyer?
Yeah.
I don't think it should be a kid by himself being interviewed for something.
It's really ridiculous to me that they, one, waive the Miranda rights, and also, like, signed, yeah, it's fine, he can be interviewed without a parent. Like, who did that? Did Barb really sign off on that? I think she did. Right? I don't think that was fully explained to her then. Because I don't think if she understood, oh, he's going to be in there for 4 hours by himself while they lob ideas at him and ask him to tell them a story.
Because it was very strange how they asked, they go about, like, being like, so what happened? And then he's like, well, finally, after so long, because he just keeps saying, I don't know. And then they're like, you were there. And he's like, no. And they're like, look, we know the truth.
We know you were there. We know you did it. Her in the bedroom.
And now let's think about it. If you are the nephew of a man who went to jail.
Twice now.
Well, for the first time, for sure. When he went to jail for 18 years for something he didn't do and for something that he told the cops continuously, I didn't do it.
Right.
And they were like, well, now you're going to be fucked for real.
Right.
And then he hears these cops tell him, look, it'll be a lot easier if you just tell us.
Right, just say the things we're saying, and you can go back to school. You can do your homework, you can get out of here, like, it's not going to be a problem, we'll help you out.
And he's noticing in the beginning that they're getting frustrated because he just keeps saying, I don't know.
Right.
And, like, no.
They clearly have an end goal in mind that he is not delivering. Yeah.
Yeah, and then when he begins to, like, finally come up with shit, it's not what they want to hear. They're like, yeah, exactly. But now, what did you do here? And he's like, oh, I did this. And they're like, no.
No, you didn't. You didn't.
What about this?
Didn't you do this?
And he's like, yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But there's always a long pause where he seems to, like, think about it and then, like, sure, I'll agree.
Sure.
Yeah, it's like, it's never something that he, like, embellishes on things that they give him. Instead of vice versa, right? They're not picking up the pieces he's feeding them. It's the other way around. They're saying, hey, find a way to make this work. What about this piece of thing?
Yeah.
What about this idea?
Yeah.
And so it's very dirty. And so 3 of the 7 judges basically call it out. And 4 of them are bamboozled. When they're
trying to get up.
So the Brendan storyline is very difficult because it's basically 3 times they go up to bat and get said no to. In some ways, right? So they get a victory around the second time, and they're like,
to appeal,
right? And then the court turns around and overturns their victory, and they go further down the process, and then they lose there. So,
but I thought it was more like they get a victory in their judging, but then the state attorney keeps saying no,
right?
I don't think that should be.
And then they overturn one of the woman's the judge's rulings. They get rid of one of her decisions. Mm-hmm. So it goes back to a tie, and then they reopen it for the 7 judges this time.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that was the whole judging panel now checks it out. And the same 2 that said no the first time, and 2 more people, or 1 more person, are on the side saying, look, Brendan was, like, coerced into this statement, basically.
Yeah.
It's just a very tragic story, because it's the same thing over and over again while people aren't taking the time or understanding the full story that's happening here, because it's not being connected to the larger context of what is happening in this whole investigation.
Like, Brendan's lawyers are very passionate in helping him, but I think, honestly, this Kathleen lady, she calls everybody's bullshit. She's like, this is where you went wrong.
You missed this.
You missed that.
You're not doing this.
And she calls out what the lawyers are doing wrong for Brendan, because she's like, they're not telling the story is the problem. As a lawyer, your job is to tell a story that is the most believable with the most evidence.
It is tied to the evidence of reality and makes the most sense.
Don't just answer questions and be like, yes, no. You gotta, like, create.
You're not there on the defensive. You are there to fully give the judges an understanding of what happened to Teresa Halbach and why Brendan Dassey and, on tangentially related, Stephen Avery are not connected to that murder, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the story with Brendan.
Okay, spoiler thing, I think, though, is what she also brings to this case, which is the pointing the finger at some other people who might have committed this crime, right? If these fuckers didn't do it, look who might have done it and had motive, opportunity, and, you know, a lack of alibi or whatever the 3 requirements are.
And these are the 3 people that she kind of says.
Call them out, baby.
It's Ryan Hillegas, who is the ex-boyfriend.
Right.
And then there's Mike Halbach? Yeah, Mike Halbach is the brother of Teresa. And
sure.
And then also
Well, there's four then people.
Yeah, four. And then there's also Bobby Dassey.
Bobby Dassey.
He's the star witness for the prosecution.
Right.
Or the... Is it the prosecution?
Yeah, the prosecution.
Yeah.
And also the creepy motherfucker with the crazy shit on his computer, which they reveal in, like, episode 9.
He has some very difficult topics.
Some dark shit on his hard drive.
And then his stepdad.
Right.
The
man who's going to be his stepdad.
Who is also the stepdad of Brendan.
Right, right. And he's marrying Barb, the mother of the kid who's in jail. Like,
this is all Shakespeare. This is so much Shakespeare.
Such a family tragedy playing out. Like, it started with Mark Twain writing about this in Huckleberry Finn. The family's having this feud and, like, destroying themselves, basically, in front of everyone else. The same shit is happening out in 2018 in the middle of Wisconsin. Like, it's sad because this mother is going to get what she wants. She's going to get her son, Brendan, home at the cost of losing her other son, who seems like he's kind of fucking crazy,
right? And he is the one who said, like, he gave two different stories.
Right, he lies on behalf of the prosecution.
One of them was on trial almost against his brother.
Yes.
And he was like, yeah, I saw her.
Yeah.
I saw Teresa at the Avery place, and she didn't leave.
Right. He commits perjury in one trial or in some aspect of the trial.
And then later, several years later, he says...
He tells other people that, yeah,
mom,
I saw her leave.
I saw her leave.
Right.
And it's like...
Man.
What is your story? What are you saying?
My biggest argument for this show, if you're going to watch it, try watching just episode 1, 5, 8, 9, 10. Because that's the half of this season that really matters.
Yep.
And that is what Kathleen Zellner brings to the table. Because the other episodes are her going, look, we're putting together a lot of fucking shit here. Episode 5 is her dropping off, you know, like 1,000 pages worth of research that she did.
Yeah, it's basically all the season is just her gathering evidence.
Right.
And
making
a case, talking about
understanding
the
what didn't work.
It's great to see her scientific...
Yes.
Like, expert...
Procedure-ness of it is great. It's like a better version of a CSI.
Yeah.
Because you get to see how it really would work in the real world.
Yeah.
And have these experts who are not, like, camera-ready people who are just like, yeah, no, that would work, that wouldn't work. Yeah, this makes sense, this doesn't make sense. They're, like, actual scientists being consulted on things that happen in real life, but it's being told and woven together in a really well-done way. It's just very meandering because there's so much to these cases.
Yeah, so here's kind of the timeline of the Teresa Halbach case, I
sure,
guess.
Yeah. This is
so
the,
like,
corrected timeline according to Kathryn Zellner.
So, October 31st is the last day that anybody has ever seen Teresa Halbach.
Sure. What a shitty Halloween.
I know. And then November 3rd is the day that the RAV4 is spotted by the highway and by a random truck driver.
Right.
And then November 4th is the day that that random truck driver sees the sign for the missing girl and tells a cop that he sees nearby that, hey, that car for the missing girl is down the street.
Right. I saw it.
And then on November 5th is when the RAV4 is found.
Right.
Which...
And that cop is the creepy motherfucker associated and having his hands in every pie in this case. I don't remember his name.
He was in season... Yes. Sergeant Colburn.
Colburn.
He was in season 1 and he's one of the reasons that, like, that the state fucked up.
Right.
In the first season.
Right.
He was giving all of this. He was like, oh, yeah, you know, I was, you know, giving all this evidence that is just bullshit.
Right.
And then when they kind of go back to him.
Right,
he's
and call him on
so,
it.
So,
yeah,
like, I can't remember.
He's
I don't
like
know.
An incompetent schmuck who thinks he knows what the fuck's going on and then gets caught with his pants down and is just wide-eyed and scared at the end.
Yes.
And now it's revealed that he had more information and probably used that to plant evidence in this case and further obstruct justice.
Because now the truck driver can identify that is the cop.
Right.
Like
he sees season 1 of Making the Murderer and goes, oh my god, that's the guy I told. Like him right there. He's not telling what happened. Why hasn't he said that? Yeah.
That I told him. The car's over there. And then the crazy part is that on November 4th, I believe, he calls, or maybe it's November 3rd, he calls the police station and says, I want to get an identification on, and then says the plate of the car.
Sure.
And then they're like, oh, that's the car of the missing girl. And he's like, 99 RAV4. Yeah, yeah. Like, just describes the car.
Right.
Almost as though it's in front of him.
Yeah, he's staring at it.
He's like, staring at it going, is that...
Is this Colburn does this?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That happens right after that truck driver tells him in the gas station.
And then...
Wow, okay.
November 5th, fast forward a day or two,
mm-hmm.
that car is somehow... found on the Avery lot.
Right, in a different place now.
And really it's kind of smashed up. Poorly covered.
Right, and like shit is thrown against it as if it's covered in the dark.
In my mind, I'm like, if you are Stephen Avery, let's say that you did it.
Why would you leave the car, bro?
You have access to destroying a car.
That is the first car you destroy when you get home.
The first car you put away.
Yes. And you put the body in the middle of that car and you smash that bitch down.
What? What do you mean what is this idea that he burned the body when he could have easily just...
What a dumb fucking story that the prosecution weaves.
Well, just put it in the trunk and smash that car.
Yeah, throw that bitch in the back seat in a bag. And smash that car down. It would never be found.
It does. It just...
could melt the steel down.
I don't know.
It does not make sense at all. Whatever. We don't need to relitigate that because it's so clear that Stephen Avery really didn't do this because of the counterexample.
And if he did, have that little doubt in my head. I'm like, but what if he did?
Yeah.
What if he did do it?
2% of you is just like, oh God.
But what if he did?
Yeah.
And if he did, then I guess, wow, you must be really, really an idiot.
Yeah. I don't know how you could both be an idiot and get away with this, but also not. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it seems really difficult for him to be not very smart and do this crime, go to jail for it, but throughout the whole time maintain a plausible story of how he didn't do it. You know what I mean? Like, that's such a brilliant job acting for so long.
Yeah, and I think after Kathleen Zellner presents everything, that's when you really realize that he is innocent.
Right. There's at least one, if not two, other sets of people who could have pulled this off.
Yeah, so here is, the big kind of clue and her timeline. She gives an actual timeline for how this murder went. And I'm like, please. You are a queen in this.
Dude.
Is that she figures out that there's phone records.
Mm-hmm.
So she's called... Yes, she is in touch with Avery.
Right.
Stephen Avery. They take a picture.
Well, Halbach is. Yeah, Teresa Halbach is in touch.
Yes. And she takes a picture of the van that he wants to sell.
Right.
Then from there, she's writing in her planner after this.
Right. Making phone calls while she's
setting
driving.
Setting up appointments to go to her next place.
Right.
But look for, the next day or something, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, tomorrow I'm going to go here at 3 p.m. and then here at 4 p.m.
And her cell phone records prove that she was on the phone with these people after her meeting with Avery.
Right.
And now the cell phone tower is now connecting her to the other side of the Avery lot.
Right. She's no longer on the Avery property, and she's moving, and everybody that's talked to her on the phone says, she was driving and had to pull over every time we were chatting with her. Yeah.
Yeah. And now you realize that she is, because of the cell phone tower tracking, she is close to where Scott...
Right.
Scott Dassey, I think is his last name, is. Well, basically the stepdad of Brendan.
What's his name? Taldick or something. Toldick or something, yeah. Look it up.
But that right there sets it up so perfectly. And then also the fact that Avery's testimony of, she was here, she was with me, and I came inside, I put the book down that she gave me, and then when I came inside, I noticed Bobby...
Yeah, Bobby Dassey.
The guy who has the creepy shit on his laptop, who lives close by, who is the brother of the guy
himself,
in jail right now.
Who noticed Teresa Halbach pull up to the property in the 10 minutes that she was there, maybe, right?
Yeah.
She was there for 5 to 10 minutes, took some pictures of a car and drove away. And in that time, that bitch got his keys, got in his truck and left within the same minute that Avery was in his little trailer and left. Put some shit down and walked back out, and Bobby Dassey is gone.
Yeah.
So, and what is, I think, the best part of this entire season is them recreating that and kind of telling you the tale of what she's pieced together by, like, all of these people corroborating evidence, right? Mm-hmm. They recreate how Bobby Dassey could have caught up with her while she was driving and had a conversation with her and probably wrecked her against the fucking back of her vehicle and then carried her body and, like, cut her up and buried her in the woods.
There was also something interesting that he said before when he was like, oh, I didn't see her leave. I went to go take a shower because I was going to go for a hunt.
Right.
And then after his whole whatever, hunt or shower, whatever, he says, oh, her car was still there.
Right. Yeah, and he says he just leaves before she leaves to go on his hunt. But
which I'm like, that is also a very kind of...
Hunting what?
Yeah, what are Bobby? You hunting?
Yeah.
And...
Bow hunting, nonetheless.
And he has experience in killing animals and also dismembering them. They have, like, these burial pits where they throw, like, animal remains and burn them. And there's the whole idea that, like, they reconstructed how it happened and how... the way that they were reconstructing these facts fit to
all like, of the blood, witness evidence. Yeah, it matches the DNA.
It makes
where
more
the blood.
Sense.
Right. It makes sense how
than the story of the of
right the prosecution. Mm-hmm. Right. The fact that a light from the car, there's damage to the car, and there's like a light found in the trunk matches the plausible story of how it could have gotten put on the Avery property. Right. We understand where Teresa Halbach would have been. People's cell phone records match them locationally, like through towers tracking Bobby Dassey and her, right? So the idea is that wherever her RAV4 was found, she was probably killed near there. And then buried, because that's also where the scent dogs track her as a burial site, right? The burial dog goes off in that spot and there's nothing found.
So when they discover... the car on the lot, when they're like doing these search groups to try to find her, they discover that her car is on the Avery lot, and then they bring these cadaver dogs,
right?
And these cadaver dogs at first point them into this
the
random
neighboring property.
Yeah, the neighboring, that's a kind of away from the lot.
They go and into wandering this fucking and through another property
into
like
what
a
looks
lot
like
more.
A weird almost burial site. It has it's like covered by like giant wood.
Yeah, it's like a gravel
stuff.
Pit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the dogs are interested in that place at first. And then they kind of go around and kind of like show you.
Right.
They give an outline of how everything could have moved.
Right. The dogs walk in a path that is plausible for how you could have killed somebody and moved their car onto the Avery lot.
Yeah. Because at the
Seems
end, it's
convenient.
Only at the very end that the dogs end up going to the Avery lot. And they're
right.
like, this is
at
where
the very
she
end, by the car, right? That's when they find the car as the dogs. The rest of it is on somebody else's property, and there's a burial site at the other end of that property with no bones, conveniently, because they've gotten dug up and removed somewhere.
Yeah. Also...
yeah, it's a whole bunch of fucked. And so this season really lays it out nicely, I think. Like, kudos to Catherine Zellner, and especially the, like, the editing of episodes 8 through 10, because they lay out this counter-argument very, very strongly, along with all of the argument of how evidence got placed and fucked up and tampered with by the police department, who had some sort of vendetta. So there's two, like, possible things also pointed at Stephen Avery, like two people he's caught in the crossfire of, and it's just this confluence of bad luck all around for these poor like fucks out in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I think with God, she's just such a strong female character in this. When she has her story and she's like, this is what happened, this is the time, this is the structure of what occurred on those days, and says that it was actually Bobby and Scott.
Bobby Dassey.
Now, the next part after that
next
is
episode.
Barbara, who is
Barb calls
Brendan. Brendan's mom.
Right.
She calls, not Brendan, she calls Avery. And she's like,
oh, you're right.
What
it's
the
Steve.
Fuck is she doing?
Yeah.
She's trying to destroy my family.
Right.
And then he's like, I don't know. But
I don't know what's happening. She's just trying to find the truth.
Yeah, she's just doing the truth.
She said she's going to try to figure out who the killer
she
is.
She says twice. She's like, if you don't stop this,
you're
going to have a dead sister. And I'm like, what the fuck does that mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, are
season
you in
three
danger?
Could be extremely
or are
dark.
You, yeah.
No,
or
no, no,
are
I don't
you
think
just
it's...
so, like, this is so Shakespeare that you're, like, having that downfall?
Yeah, there's some suicidal thoughts going on here. Like, can't imagine her.
So much.
Yeah, for years she spent desiring her long lost son to come home, and the proposition now is trade your other son for that reality.
Yeah,
right. And that is what the truth. Yeah, and your husband who helped cover it up and has been holding your hand and staring you down. Right.
It makes sense.
Totally fits, and it is the perfect way that this simulation of reality is pulling this story together.
So Bobby, Brendan's brother, on his hard drive had, like, so much really tough porn.
Yeah, graphic, and then, deviant, violent porn of women being drowned and dismembered.
Yeah, and then just random stuff of, like, you younger know, women, like, what was it? Like, accident.
Pedophilia, yeah.
Car accident.
Yeah, broken, like, dismembered bodies.
So many random searches that you're like,
yeah, like, why did it? The list is, like, hundreds long.
That is linking right to that murder specifically.
Plus thousands of images that are actually saved on the hard drive. Like, this is not just a mild fantasy one afternoon.
No, this is something you saved.
Hundreds of hours of research being done about the most macabre, fucked up, deviant porn.
It's graphic.
Yeah.
It's very graphic. And
this is intentionally left out of the original case,
mm-hmm.
which is so fucked up. That they didn't get that until 12 years after the original investigation.
And then also the fact that there's another brother in this whole situation. And this other brother says, no, Bobby specifically said that he saw her leave.
Yeah.
And he's like, and he's like,
he said that the whole time. And he's like, nobody, no.
And everybody's like, shut up.
Shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up.
That's
don't listen to that guy.
That's not what we
want to
hear.
Yeah. This guy's just in the background like, by the way,
guys,
pretty sure he said she saw, like, she left and he left right in the same minute. Like, kind of weird. You might want to check him out.
But nobody wanted to go talk to him.
You know what the crazier thing would be is if the ex-boyfriend somehow was also trying to kill her at the same time and, like she got pulled over by Bobby and he doesn't actually do it, but the ex-boyfriend does it. Like, how crazy. I don't think that's really what it is. I think the guy who hunts a lot and was prepared to go hunting and saw a woman who he's obsessed with and matches the identities of women in his deviant porn and violent porn, that seems far more likely as the murderer, right?
Yeah, but it's also interesting. This is where the ex-boyfriend is kind of linked in. So the ex-boyfriend finds the planner in her house.
Right, which could have only been in her car because it was updated as she was driving.
Yeah, there's no way that could have
made it back to her house.
She couldn't have gone back to her house before.
Right.
She must have. It had to be in the car.
Right.
And
this motherfucker just shows up and gives that to the police as evidence.
And he's the one also that's also leading this.
Right.
The
he's
search.
The most keen to find her.
Yeah. And doesn't want to be interviewed, doesn't want to talk about
it. Has no involvement with the documentary.
It's very strange. Also, when he's being questioned in court, there's parts that he can't remember. He's like, I don't know. He didn't have a good alibi.
No.
He did not. He was like, I don't know.
Right. And so my question is, how small of a town is this? Do you think Ryan Hillegas knows Bobby Dassey? And maybe there was an involvement there and he helped move the car and bury the body? Like, what the fuck do you think happened here, man? Like, my hope is that this documentary pulls out of its, like, navel-gazing, like, meanderingness. Because we spent the first season really dealing with how shitty it is for the human tragedy of this family that is surrounding these five or six people, right? The mother, the father, who just want to work at their junkyard, the brother, right? All of these people are caught in this vortex of shit.
Because
they're
weird.
Between the police department, right, and Stephen Avery, because they're different.
Yeah.
Right? They're the unknown of this small town.
Yeah.
And then there are these seemingly small-time villains who have done some fucked up shit and gotten away with it, who now have national scrutiny and the power of Netflix staring down at them and reevaluating these cases. Like, what the fuck is going to happen in the next year or two with this case as season 3 unfolds? Like, I have no idea.
I don't know, but it's really sad.
It's very sad.
I can't
sad.
Imagine. I try to put myself in, like, Brendan's shoes and imagine me being a 16-year-old and being interviewed by the cops.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I would be so scared. One, be so scared. But
I get pulled over and my heart is effing racing,
yeah.
right? Can you imagine being in a room alone with two police officers for hours?
For a murder.
Right.
I know it's a murder.
Yeah.
And it's somehow connected to your family.
Right, and you don't understand what the fuck's happening.
But you just want to say the right thing.
Right, you just want to get out of there. You just want to make these people happy because they're the only people around. And if nothing better than just make them, you know, on your side and get you out of there.
It's sad because as soon as the cops are done interviewing him, they bring the mom in. And the first thing he says is, like, they got into my head.
Yeah.
And you can see it. You can see that it's so genuine. It's almost like he's finally out of a trance.
Right.
And is like,
he's just woken up from, like, a hypnotism almost. Yeah, like God damn, what did I just say?
Yeah. Like, I didn't mean to say that, but they got into my head. They told me to.
Right. They fed me words and then pulled them back out of me is, like, how it seems. Yeah.
It's just scary to think like that. Like, only because of the time that we're in right now, we're hearing this story.
Yeah.
But this has been going on for a while.
Hun, I mean, this... Think about the Salem witch trials. Yeah. Like, this shit has always been happening. Yeah. We're just getting better and better at, one, noticing when it happens, and two, being able to undo things like this.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully season 3 ends with him coming out of jail, or Brendan at least coming out of jail.
Or at least finding somebody finding new evidence.
I feel like there's so much new. Yeah.
Is also good. Like, the fact that they, like, took... they have this theory that there's a chapstick with his saliva on it.
Right,
and
that's what's at the crime scene at the time.
The hood. Because they
said... the hood, on the bullet fragment, yeah, all of that shit, yeah.
They're just taking all this evidence and planting it in places, which makes sense because...
How else would there be that much DNA on a bullet fragment? Yeah, like, all of these things are very strange.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. So
I don't know what's going to happen here.
I think the questions largely set up by season 1 are answered in season 2. I think they don't tell you any answers until, like, episode 8, basically. Mm-hmm. They hold it real close to the chest.
But even then, it's not fully
satisfying. Half of them are answered, and it's not that satisfying yet. Mm-hmm. Because of how slowly justice moves, and it's only been 3 years, right? If you think about the length of time this entire case has taken...
I'm sorry, can I go back to the phone call with Barb?
Please. Oh my god, we totally forgot. We moved away. We're coming back.
But she said on that phone call, so we're going back
to Barb.
You're
going to have a dead sister.
Dead sister is where we left it. But then afterwards, you hear Scott in the background and be like, let me talk to him.
Fuck that guy, he's a fucking lying asshole.
But also before all that, Barb says, like, no, he wasn't there. He was with me. And then she's like, at 5... and beyond, but it was like, so what happened before 5?
Yeah, apparently, she left at 1:38.
Yeah, the murder is somewhere at 1:30.
Between 1:40 and 5
and
o'clock.
Like, yeah.
Seems like enough time to get rid of a body and murder somebody, not in that order.
Yeah, and the fact that she, at that moment, she shouldn't have said anything.
No.
That she said 5 o'clock and
the
on.
Way that the documentary series plays out that phone call, too, is brilliant, because there's no people on screen. It's literally just, like, a blurred out shot of the prison. Steven's dialogue is on top. Barb's is in the middle. And Scott's pops in below. And it's just, like, yelling in all caps. Yeah. And just like, fuck you, Steven Avery, you lying piece of shit. Like, he just comes out of nowhere, super aggro, 0 to 100 with no warning. And just, like, firing
you see
blindly.
This other
and you're like,
character that you're like,
and
I haven't seen this.
This guy's just been sitting calmly holding her hand the whole time. And now he feels like he's a little threatened.
Now you've poked the bear.
Yeah, you poked the bear who's been getting away with murder for 12 fucking years.
Possibly.
Maybe.
Maybe he didn't murder the person, but maybe he helped get rid of it.
He knows more than he's told anyone, for sure.
I think for sure you have somebody with Bobby.
Yeah.
There's just something strange. There's something that does not smell right there.
Look, if there's smoke, there's fire, I think is where we're at now with Bobby Dassey. Like, this is... There's too many dominoes stacked against him to at least not consider him and do some more follow-up.
We need, like, somebody else who knows, also part of the story.
Yeah.
To say something.
What we really need is Kathleen Zellner in a fucking courtroom arguing this story. Because every time she critiques the other lawyers, you're like, yeah, why is that not being said? We're all thinking that.
Yeah. But it's, a lawyer's job is so difficult. And I feel bad because she comes up with such... good theories and good proof and presents it to the courts and they just deny her. They're like, nope.
Well, the problem is that she's not even having the chance yet to personally present them. They're giving them stacks of documents, and I think the state is reflexively saying no. simply because of the weight of evidence they're being presented, right? Like, imagine having to turn around 1,000 pages of reading in a week, right? Yeah. To a national case that affects a man's, you know, life sentence in jail, right? That's immense pressure. And so their knee-jerk reaction would be is like, fuck you, get the hell out of our face, right? They don't want to admit that they fucked up on this guy's behalf.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the incentives are against Stephen Avery here. And so she is rightly acknowledging, like, how much effort it's going to take, but she seems up to the task.
She's like, yep, I think this is what she's made for, this honestly. This is
exactly
this
what she's been waiting
she's
for.
She's already overturned, I think it was like 18 or 16 other trials. A lot trials. More than that,
yeah.
No, but that's a lot. Even that, that's
even
a
that,
lot.
Even that, yeah.
She's proven that these people...
She knows what the fuck to do.
Oh, she's so good. And yeah. If anything, watch it merely for her.
Yeah.
Or just follow her on Twitter.
Follow her. Her tweets are fucking golden. Okay.
She calls people out. She drags them.
I would like to make a small side note rant about Ken Kratz.
Oh, God.
Because if you want to hate anything in this show, Ken Kratz opens himself up to be that target. Yeah. So perfectly throughout this season. He is such an unlikable, sweaty piece of shit throughout this show.
He is a soft-spoken, evil, unnecessary evil.
He's the vampire who's glamming on for the press and the prestige and the reputation.
Because he wrote a book, you know?
He wrote a book. He's, like, so flagrantly just hawking himself in place of justice and just talking nonsense. And I love when Kathleen Zellner actually gets to, like, talk to him down. But even her tweets, man, she fucking shoots arrows at that.
Mm-hmm.
Ken Kratz, who speaks like this, you know, he's
no,
kind of...
it's actually a little higher.
Oh, yeah, it's more like, hey, everyone. So what we've got here is Stephen Avery, a convicted murderer I helped prosecute.
So this guy is the original mustache. Is the original prosecutor on the Stephen Avery.
Ex-prosecutor of Stephen Avery.
And then has to step down because he has a very inappropriate relationship with a woman who has been abused by her husband. And now he's sending her, like, sexting messages and, like, pictures and stuff like that. And she's like, bro,
yeah,
he's get a off
sweaty
my
creep.
Dick.
And, like, he sends her, like, 50 text messages in one day. Like, lewd, disgusting.
Insane.
Yeah.
And he's like, I have to step down.
And now he is back in the courtrooms to talk about Stephen Avery. Let's talk about the night.
So now it's Brendan's case, and they've just done their job and everything. And he is the one who's leading the press conference. He has nothing to do with this trial, nothing at all. But he's like,
I wrote a book.
I used to be the prosecutor in the original Stephen Avery trial.
I'm here
to answer questions.
To talk about my book, but I do have a book available if you'd like to buy it. My name is Ken Kratz. The book is called, like, he is clearly there for the attention and the spotlight pouring of, like, the history that he's involved with.
Yeah.
That he is so blind to the, like, various crimes he's basically committing. Like, he is openly slandering, like, all of the people involved. He's just shooting himself in the foot in public, but, like, has no tact or understanding of what the fuck he's doing. Like, Ken Kratz, man, what a slimy, gross motherfucker.
No, karma comes back around. That's all I gotta
say. It's coming, baby.
It's coming for him
hard. In the form of Kathleen Zellner, the freight train of justice.
Yzma.
I am here.
Wait, is that correct, Yzma? Yeah.
From Emperor's New Groove?
Yeah.
Yes.
She's Yzma.
Yzma. Yes.
But,
Pull the lever of justice!
But yeah, that's what's going on so far with Making a Murderer. See, you didn't have to watch 10 hours worth.
There are three options here. Don't watch it at all and listen to us.
Mm-hmm.
Watch 5 hours of it. 1, 5, 8, 9, 10. Those episodes are worth watching. Mm-hmm. They don't dwell on the phone calls between the sad people caught in the middle of this tragedy who we spent all season one dealing with the sad tragedy of their lives anyways. Or watch the whole thing and get frustrated with the repeated drone shots and inserts of poor
Teresa Hallbark.
Ugh. Her with her little camera.
This thing that happens also at the very end, when the episode is wrapped up, they have a shot at the end with all the names of people that refuse.
Every episode.
That refuse to do interviews.
They have the shots fired list.
Yeah. And you see, like, all the people.
Yeah, they're like 50 who names, said, no, 100 names. I don't want to be interviewed. Like, leave me out of Netflix, baby. Man, I get that choice, but at the same time, man, some of those people
need to be interviewed.
But they need to be interviewed in the same way that, like, Durst needed to be interviewed. You know what I mean? Like, we just need some closure on this.
We need Kathleen interviewing all these people. Let
me put it this way. I don't want Making the Murderer to continue past season 3. I want all of them to be...
I don't even want season 3. I just want, like, final. Like, the finale. It's coming,
though. Yeah, I want season 3 to be the end. Goddamn.
Yeah.
If you have to give me 10 more episodes, fine. You know I'll watch them.
It's gonna take a while. We know this is the reality. This isn't just a show. This is somebody's life.
Okay, so let's just think about this for a second. So there's maybe 100 million Netflix subscribers.
Mm-hmm.
Right, unique subscribing accounts, which means, you know, everybody shares it with at least one person. So there's maybe 200 million people that have access to this TV show.
Yeah.
How many people you think watch this shit? Like, is it 10%? Is it 10 million, 20 million people, 50 million people may be aware of these, like, this junkyard in the middle of Wisconsin and the tragedy that's focused on it? Man.
Somebody knows something. That's what...
Someone is going to come forward. Like, there have been some people coming forward. It's only going to continue unraveling.
We'll see.
Man.
But that was Making a Murderer.
Season 2.
I don't even...
Can we get back to watching House of Cards? My God.
Yeah,
like, we watched the first episode of House of Cards. Yeah. That is our reward
here.
We are
going to have a lot to say, I think, for House of Cards.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, we will.
I
already have so many thoughts, but that'll be for another episode.
Yeah.
So we have officially made the murderer. I believe it's Bobby. He is the most likely suspect. Let me put it that way. I think there's definitely some shady involvement with so-and-so Hilligus. Who had the planner from the...
Oh, yeah, that's a very interesting...
I got brother some questions too. About that.
It's just very interesting, their dynamic. The brother, Teresa Hallbrook's brother, and the ex-boyfriend, because I feel like in those cases, you always have to see who is the closest one to her and be like, what do they get out of this?
Right. Who's pinged up against Teresa Hallbrook in the past before this murder, right? Who has the most to gain by killing her? Who has the most...
What do they get?
Right. I think there are fewer questions to answer now, but there are still some unanswered questions that Mrs. Zellner will be dealing with, I hope. Also, hilariously, she looks exactly like my middle school English teacher. but, like, the insanely equipped, like, lawyer version.
Yeah.
Like, ugh, what a boss.
So,
if you really just want to see a dope lawyer at work... And the procedure of what goes into that, and how many minions she controls.
They're so great.
The young 20-year-olds that she vampires off. Yeah,
I think I have a quote of the day, but it's a very sad quote of the day.
Tragic documentary.
This is Stephen Avery talking to his parents from jail, and he says, "Poor people lose. Poor people lose all the time."
Yep.
And that's truth.
Man, I can't imagine spending 30 years of my life in prison.
And spending all my money because the Stephen Avery auto car thing is like...
Yeah, that junkyard's going dying. Out of business.
It's dying, and it's because they gave all their money to this. To pay for lawyers, to pay for tests, to pay for all of this
stuff. If you were innocent, though, wouldn't you do the same? Like,
yeah, I would. I need to get out of there.
It's sad, and yet it would play out exactly the same way if I was in those shoes.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest part, is you know that, like, everybody's doing their best, and sometimes it's still not enough. And that's the real tragedy of this whole show, I think.
Yep. So.
Man, what a downer. That's why we waited so long to watch it. Yeah. The other thing I was going to say, just real quick, is I wonder how much Stephen Avery has grown as a human being, just being stuck by himself. Like, this, like, basically enforced meditation. For
maybe.
30 years. Do you think he's grown at all? Because the way he speaks now versus in the trial and stuff, like, he seems like such a person who has really spent the time getting to know himself a lot more in the last years he's been away.
Agreed. I agree on that part, but he does seem like he's grown.
Yeah.
He's grown, even though he's in
for the better or
such
worse,
a suffocating place.
Yeah. Grown under really shitty circumstances for sure. Huh? All right.
That was Making a Murderer.
One more episode in the bag, baby. Netflix. No. You got so much shit going on.
Let's go back to
Shall we continue watching?
Yeah.
What you wanna watch. You know. What everybody hears. All right, thanks for listening. Bye.